It's just past 18 hours, 31 minutes and 6 seconds East African time. Time for John Sibi Okumu on Wednesday. This being Wednesday, the 5th of April, 2023. Hamjambo na karibuni. Hello and welcome. In this edition, we turn to the L word, literature. As a reader and writer myself, for a long time, I have stored a quote in one of my all-important scrapbooks for the written and spoken word. The American Saul Bellow, winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1976, apparently once asked, "Who is the Tolstoy of the Zulus? Who is the Proust of the Papuans?" and added, "I'd be happy to read them." To his mind, so it seems, certain cultures were condemned to literary inferiority. We will address that statement later on. But in the build-up, we will make bold to address the subject of great literature from Kenya since our independence in 1963. My guest bears a halo that loudly proclaims man of letters. And so you, dear listener, are going to be in for an entertaining and hopefully edifying back and forth. But to respond to literature, we need readers, which is why we put this introductory question to some obliging people out there. Have you found the time to read literature books since you left school?
No, I had no time for that because I'm busy struggling in my life.
Okay, I've been reading books, especially novels.
Yeah, I have, but minimal. You know, in this era, you feel like it's kind of taking a lot of your time going back to the books, reading books, while you can get it instantly on the internet or online.
I read the novels, Kiswahili storybooks, I like.
Tangu nitoke shuleni, sijaweza kusoma kitabu chochote. Reason being, hustling here and there, kwa kupata wakati meza kuwa ni shida kidogo.
If I come across the books, I can pitia kidogo kidogo, but most of the time I have a phone. You can Google something you want, you can read.
I used to read books for leisure, fictional stories, like Jackie Collins, James Patterson. On my spare time, that was in campus, that was a while ago, yeah.
So, what do you think of those comments?
Well, the comments are a reflection of our association of education and the limiting view of education. I think that we associate learning with school. So the moment you step out of school, then we've no use for reading. So that's a limited view of reading, or what you can call reading culture in our country. We should always perhaps remember we read to enjoy ourselves. It's a way of relaxing. And many of our respondents are right in that our education does not prepare us to read for life. That's my overarching response to their sentiments.
Dugu, there's something that you was coming across for me. Some people just weren't interested in reading, and there were some people who were saying that there are alternative ways to. It's been somewhat displaced by social media, our phones. The idea of picking up a book and reading it is too much like hard work.
Yeah, it's a quick fix mentality that's very prevalent in our society. I think even what they find on the phone is written. So somebody wrote what they're reading. So in a sense, we have not quite gotten rid of the need for writers, or we can say they are reading things that are to be found within easy access. Perhaps we can say they are reading differently, but they are reading still.
Right. Remember, we had the qualification great literature, and we have hovering over us that quote from Bellow, which we'll address more pointedly later on. but I'm still interested in, there's somebody there who said, I just don't bother with books. And there were people who were perhaps reading what might be presumed to be lightweight literature. If you sort of mention Jackie Collins, that's not the apogee of literary delight, is it?
Well, who makes the call? Who is judging great literature? Is it a critic? Is it a reader of literature? Is it a student of literature? I am challenging the presumption that there is great and inferior literature. In fact, Bellow's own sentiment. It's something I'd like to respond afterwards. But we have institutions of memory that decide what should be read and what should be ignored. So perhaps even within our very context, we can say there are great writers who have emerged in this country that were trivialized, say Charles Mangua or David Mailu, because they're writing what you call popular literature or pop literature. And we need to access all layers of readers. So those who are going to read Anton Chekhov, for instance, and find the same sexual connotations to his text that might appear offensive to some readers, is really what Milo was doing, maybe a little differently and more directly, without any veneer of sophistication. So those who read American pop, are as credible readers.
I'm still going on to this idea of the register of language being used. Let's assume that there is a great writer in Kiswahili, and the vocabulary is huge, extremely wide, and you're trying to suggest that you will equate the register of language used by somebody like David Mailu to the level of Russian in translation used to translate Chekhov. You're calling them both great. I find that hard to give a prize to both of them for greatness.
Well, I was talking about readers, and readers' choices should be respected.
Yes.
So I would say Mailu is a great writer in Kenyan context. And whether his lenses are deep enough or penetrating enough to understand our psyche, or what it means to be human in our very context, which is what great literature does. Great writings approximate truth. What it means to be a Russian growing in 19th century, or what Mailu was doing, trying to understand what it means to be Kenyan in 20th century. So the idea of judgment is what I'm trying to challenge, that there is no universal or universalized response to writing. So a young reader who is taken to Jackie Collins should be allowed that, and if we say Mailu or Chekhov, regardless of their time, I mean, they wrote in different contexts, in different time periods. They have their constituency of readers, and we should encourage both.
I would say that it's always perhaps unpalatable, but if we're taking the example of that grouping called our colonial masters, there is a sense where, in order to be well read, you might somewhere along the line have encountered Shakespeare. He wrote 36 plays, but you might have encountered Dickens. You might have, and so on and so forth. If you're a playwright, you might have the Nobel Prize winners, James Joyce. No, he didn't win the Nobel Prize, but you know what I mean. There is a canon, this idea that somebody who is well-read has read such and such a book. So I'm saying, because we're looking at a national overview, have we arrived at a stage where we have such a canon?
Well, what you just highlighted is actually British national literature.
Exactly. So do we have Kenyan national literature?
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. And so even the parameters, perhaps, because you frame this conversation as post-colonial conversation.
Yes.
What happened before British settlers arrived on our shores? Didn't we have writings? Didn't we have literature?
This is always the stock answer. We had.
But we have.
We're talking to a very young audience. By definition, we know the demographic of listeners to Capital FM 98.4 is young. So if you're telling me that I'm remiss in thinking that 90% of our listeners have never heard of David Mailu, I want you to defend that. If genuinely the people listening to us are saying, oh, I gobbled up a bit of Charles Mangua last night, I don't think they have. So what's being done to... You have been exposed to them by virtue of your age, if you'd permit that kind of explanation.
Well, that's very simplistic. Yes. The first assumption that you're making is that Shakespeare appeals to the young because it's recent. He's been read for more than 200 years. So have we read texts that emerged in our region, the coastal literature, for instance, that was pre-colonial, around 18th century? I can read you the very precise text. We had Herakali manuscripts published in 1738. We have Harizia, 1747. We've got Inkishafi by Sayyid Abdallah, 1800. The poems by Fumo Liyongo.
We're talking at cross purposes. You're saying if you go into a museum, you'll see this wonderful statue that was made in the two before the birth. And I'm saying, are your children, make it personal, have they heard of any of these people that you've just listed?
Well,
I'll tell you one thing. Let me be honest with you. I haven't.
Yeah, because...
I haven't. What's wrong with me?
Because you've been a student of colonial education.
Okay. I'll take that on board.
You are indeed a manifestation of what's gone wrong. Because you started with British literature.
Yes.
Ended with British literature.
Exactly.
Where is Kenyan and East African literature?
And that, in the context of our conversation, I'm asking you, if you would, to enlighten me as to the manner in which we've had a generation which is more enlightened than I am. I've taken all your accusations on board, colonial sellout or whatever. Fine. So what's happening to our kids? Let me insult myself.
I didn't make such an accusation.
No, you're far too polite.
Well, I was simply saying, even before we can get to British literature, and this is actually English national literature, you did not even include Irish or the Scots or the Welsh literature in this canon that you just listed. And I'm saying, if we are well educated, because the accusation here, you cannot escape Shakespeare, you cannot escape Dickens if you're well educated. And I'm saying, actually, if we're well educated, how about getting grounded in our own writings? And I listed what emerged from our shores 200 years ago, same time as Shakespeare's plays. So why are we, at this very point, looking up to England, not Swahili, perhaps, as a beginning point?
Ndugu, we'll have to take a break. Thank you very much. Ndugu, I'm sure being kindred spirits, we could go on forever on some of these topics, but I'd like to move on. But on this, in the same kind of vein, I would then say to you, let me give you an image. Somebody comes up to you and says, Mr. XYZ, I'm a visitor here. I'm from Papua New Guinea. and I'm only here for a week, if I go into a bookshop and I want to acquaint myself with seminal works of literature from this country in the last 60 years. Can you think what that list might be for you? I mean, you could do 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 or 5. What would they be?
We have a unique history, and I'll say our cultural and literary history appears to start at a point when Ngugi wa Thiong'o starts writing, 1962. So I think that would be a good place to start. His seminal, one of the seminal books, A Grain of Wheat, will be an entry point for me. I would read Grace Ogot, The Promised Land. She too had a few seminal texts that emerged in the 60s. I would say, if I were to extend my category of texts, and I want to read maybe from other languages besides English, because here we are assuming English to be the medium, we have Gakara Wanjao, who was a Mau Mau detainee who wrote from detention and later became a newspaper publisher. So those three will be my beginning point to understand our context of our past.
I'm going to circle that again a bit later, but a related question again, because I have admitted to my own academic roots, and there is this word movement. There were movements. There were certain writers and kind of writing. Do you think that in 60 years there are definitive movements that have emerged?
That's an interesting question. As I said, the tragedy of literature is that it is framed largely by institutions of memory. That means the academy, and which critics perceive certain texts to be important. You've got the media, again, critics who review certain texts. By extension, you know, government institutions that allow certain books to be in circulation. So one can say there have been offshoots of movements in other parts of the world that reverberate into our shores or onto our shores. So I can say there have been generations of writers, different generations of writers in this country. But to ascribe them to belong to certain movements, I think that's a fluid manifestation. That.
What about a thematic approach? Would you go in for there was a time where we had tradition versus modernity straight after independence, so that you find this idea, the language that is talking about the customs which were destroyed, the onslaught of an alien culture. That surely was a movement where you could stick in several people trying to do the same thing.
Yeah, possibly you can say that. And I would say there was, to a great extent, and that lasted maybe the initial 50 years of Africa's publishing history, where African writers were writing back to empire, which is to try and recuperate, cultures and societies that were destroyed by colonialism. So what Ngugi does, perhaps, sorry to keep repeating his history, but you can see his early texts. We're trying to show what had been lost, perhaps. Even Chinua Achebe, by extension, he's not Kenyan, but he belongs to the same generation. There are many writing to restore what had been lost, or to remind us, at least Ngugi does that in The River Between. But the traumas of colonization and pre-colonial Africa are you can say, very defined in the first, say, 15 or 20 years of their writing. And Ngugi does shift, if I were to use his particular trajectory as a manifestation of the larger phenomenon. So by 1970s, he's writing about the post-independence disillusionment. So if you to think about these thematic areas, he does seem to be concerned through the 60s with his play The Black Hermit, which is about ethnic politics and you know, ethnic identity and the challenge of nation building. And by the time you come to his books like Wizard of the Crow, coming in this new century, he's departed from these questions of identity, but the exploitation of the masses have gained a newer layer of understanding. Different from, say, what he did with Petals of Blood, which is, you know, hacking to the same forces, the larger ideological and class struggles, but there is a more enlightened and perhaps you can say nuanced interpretation. So I'll say, if you're to think about Ngugi's movements, you have nearly three phases of his writing. Before he comes now to the fourth one, where he's writing in his own language, maybe that's part of the fourth, part of the third cycle of his evolution. So you can say the same writer manifesting in different directions at different stages of his writing career. So I would say, if we were to stick to the first one, there were other writers who are responding to the same challenges. Grace Ogot would be one of those.
I would like you to dumb down and talk to the man, woman, young person in the street. Are we saying now, in simplistic terms, that in those 60 years, only two writers emerge who are worthy of that distinction? I find it strange that you wouldn't mention somebody like, it was off the cuff question, but that you wouldn't mention somebody like Marjorie Olude Magoe, who sort of muddies the waters by having been born in Portsmouth, England, and married a Luo man and learned how to speak the Luo and become a spokesman for Kenya and for Kenyans and been a set book item for decades, maybe.
Yeah, she wrote in the 70s and 80s.
Right.
So I was starting off, you know, with our forebears.
Yes. Yes.
Of course, there is a larger, you know, cast. I haven't mentioned either Rebecca Njau, you know, writing Ripples in the Pond, Pamela Koller. You have many pioneering writers, and
yes,
I was,
but I want to take us away from the academic, you know, PhD thesis approach and say, you mentioned the fact that we have set books in this country, which have a lot to account for. Our set books are sort of, I would say, have remained the same, or the same texts have been regurgitated for decades. Okay, Marjorie Olude Magoe had her coming to birth, but then it came back again after a while. And then there were some texts which were like, you know, Joe de Graaf's Muntu, which we can count as being Kenyan. But we were actually censored in the sense that if literature is meant to be holding up a mirror up to society, there are some things that we as a society refuse to address. We wouldn't go so far as to address the issue of, say, LGBTQ+ relationships, because they're alien to our culture. So we mustn't stop. We must stop talking these little vacuums, Ndugu, and address what we're doing for our children.
Absolutely.
So that's I want you to address those terms, and also the fact. Let me tie them up in that if you have newspapers, we don't have a tradition of having constant literary reviews in each and every paper, where people see the need to analyze texts and say, go and buy this book. And then when we go into the bookshop, we find that we can't afford the book because it's too expensive. And I've spoken for so long that I want to give you the space of a break to look at that huge canvas of doubt and self-questioning. For when we return. A break.
The best mix of music, Cap Capital FM.
So, where will we go to first? I started off by saying, I said lots of things I shouldn't have, perhaps. But comment on the fact that the state is actually muzzling the expansion of literature.
Well, I think I'd like us to start by you were name dropping and you invoked Marjorie Lou de Magoy, and I said, I wasn't looking at the entire corpus of writers who emerged from our nation. I was trying to give a context of where you're coming from, and so far I have not invoked names like the great poet Jonathan Carriera, or the playwright Francis Imbuga. There have been many writers who emerged, great writers who emerged from our shores. What I want us to understand is that there's been this obsession with a quest for national literature, and I am persuaded that we should be more accommodating to allow the place for great literatures from our different nations. Because if you think about Gakara wa Wanjao, who wrote the Mau Mau Detainee, about his which chronicles his tribulations at a camp, I am persuaded, because he doesn't write in Swahili or in English, we can't even perhaps include him among our great writers. And that's a complexity of trying to forge one list that's defined as the great literature from Kenya, or our great national literature, but literatures from different nations that even perhaps produce literature in other languages. So, but before we get to the question of language, which is very, very politicized, at least in our context.
And before we get to what you want to say, mm-hmm. I still want to say Kenya at 60. Mm-hmm. We want to name and shame. I am saying, if this gentleman, Gakara, whom you speak
Wanjao.
About, yes, why not legislate? Why not impose him on our young people so that they read him, instead of having an orange book or something that prescribes that a well-read person only reads 5 books in their life while at high school, instead of saying read everything you can lay your hands on? Isn't there something that 60 years later, Ndugu, we should be reviewing?
Right.
Because we're telling our kids what to read. We're telling them what is wholesome. And the whole notion of literature should be in a way to disrupt.
Absolutely. Well, you started by highlighting great writings from England.
Yes.
Not this country.
Yes.
So we have a similar...
Let's forget that. You're the guest.
Well,
forget me and my shortcomings.
Well, I want us to acknowledge that similarly, the Kenya Institute of Curriculum Development, sitting somewhere on Moranga Road, have been reading the same texts for 60 years. So they're not aware what are the emerging and urgent issues of the day that our youthful population, comprising some 65% of the population, don't care about, because what was written in the 60s and 70s has its place, but it's not the only lens through which to see life. So my contention is that the responses that we received from our ordinary readers, walking the streets, that we played early in this program, manifest the great failure of our education, where literature is seen as a class requirement. It is something you do for school.
Well, I'm glad of life. That. I'm glad of that statement. I'm glad of that statement, because you've mentioned the word failure.
Yeah.
And in looking back, maybe we ought to acknowledge, Ndugu, that in some way we have failed our youth.
In a big way. Absolutely, absolutely, we have failed our youth. So what I think we have failed to move from is that the traditional society, and here I'm not using those words deliberately. I am very specific in the context in which we look at that past. I'm not looking at our history with romanticization or perhaps nostalgia. I'm simply saying we have moved away from the question of you know, how do we get transition from a childhood to adulthood without FGM, which seems to be a great theme for the KCD folks.
Henry Ole Kulet.
Henry Ole Kulet.
Blossoms of the Savannah.
Even Gugis. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Onwards. Yes. Yeah. Let's go away
also
from
focuses the, on
that.
On FGM.
And also, please add into this buffet the idea that we, as a society, are legislating about things that are inherently African, so that we invoke our tradition. If you look at the current sort of spiritual, religious input into state affairs, we don't do this. We Africans somehow miraculously don't die of diseases like cancer. We don't have certain sexual orientations by virtue of the fact that we are Kenyan. So as a kindred spirit, I'm talking about the young. How long are we going to sustain this veil of obfuscation?
Well, not for long, absolutely. We are not insulated against all those ills that affect everywhere else in the world. We have been deluded about perhaps our insularity against the rest of the world, but let's face it, every ill that exists in this life is manifest in our society, but because we are very good at ducking and burying our heads in the sand, we have failed to acknowledge that the vices that we see elsewhere are replicated here. But I like to use literature for the betterment of society. I think that's why writers, you know, dedicate their time and reflect and write about these things. So what I am really frustrated about is that the way we define, you know, what's important for our children to read is confined to a panel of men in chubby-cheeked men.
Right.
In,
yeah. Well,
in
yeah,
suits.
Yeah. Make some sort of summary statement about that. Then we can move on.
There is no summary to 60 years of oppression suppression.
Yes. Okay. Well, those words are nice words to hear.
Yeah. Don't rush this great travesty. We need to understand it and pack it first.
Exactly.
So, we need literature that encompasses all spheres of life. We need to move away from these Puritanist, Christian, Eurocentric understanding of literature. The most ignorant and illiterate people are at KICD.
So what do you, okay, let's, we're talking about unpacking.
Yeah.
And I'm saying if you would be, I'm not asking you to sort of be, say something and be led off to the guillotine or something. But we do have a time to sort of navel gaze when we're 60. We're not young anymore. And my preoccupation, as you know, as a teacher myself, which you know about my pedigree, I'm always interested in what kind of message we're putting across to our youth. And in terms of things, literature, we are saying to them that okay, they're on their mobile phones, and every message that you take them, it's noted, too busy to talk, you know, see you in a minute. I don't think this is a grounding. When you're being taught things, there's a kind of imposition, there's a kind of dictatorship. The teacher saying, you will learn your 12 times table. And I'm asking you, as a society, what are we asking our children to be familiar with in terms of stories told in our languages? Let's make it that general.
Okay, so I think I'd like to encourage young people to read beyond what's on the phone, because I know there is a certain sloppiness to society. If it's not on Google, then it didn't exist.
But well, it's not. Is it? Is noted a four-letter word? NOTED. No, it's a five-letter word. Every other communication I get, people note things. Yeah. I write this huge things, and I'm talk to my kids. I'm here. I'm seeing this. The sky is blue. It's azure. It's turquoise. Vermilion. and they say, noted, Dad. Okay, end of conversation. I don't think they're going to write the great novel that Saul Bellow is awaiting.
Well,
and I'm being personal.
Yeah, and I want to say, well, the first thing we need to acknowledge is that the young people on the phone are reading something. That's one.
You did say that.
Yeah. I just want to reiterate that. Mm. Secondly, even though what we seem to describe as our great literature might be inaccessible to them, why is it so? I think that's what we need to first understand. Why aren't they accessing the great writings of our day? Could it be that books are simply outpriced for their generation? Is it that books are not?
Well, that was one. Books are outpriced for everybody.
Yeah.
So if I take the fact that if you walked into, I don't know, some bookshop in New York or something, books are expensive. But I do think that as Kenyans, there's always this thing about finding Kenyan solutions to Kenyan problems, African solutions to African problems. Surely there's a debate there about how we think about making literature more accessible to people. And we've got task forces everywhere. We've got task forces looking for oil. But the understanding is, let's not go for a task force to expand literature, because in essence, literature is useless. It's a useless activity. We should find things that are more vocational. We're hearing that particular dialogue being repeated on a daily basis, that if your kid's curled up reading a 300-page book, you should rip it away from them and teach them how to dig a trench. Is that something that you will defend? Is that the world we're heading to? In which case, we're going to be extinct, and we can end this conversation and listen to some more wonderful music.
Well, and music is part of the larger corpus of literature.
Yes, indeed.
I would say that's one of the absurdities of our society, where I hear time and again men and women, especially men in very influential and powerful positions, claim that pursuit of the arts is a waste of time and resources, because we need to develop crafts and trades, plumbers and electric electricians to be absorbed by the industry. And I think that's a manifestation of the dismal and inferior education that we have received in the past 60 years. Where societies are advanced, it is the arts that manifest that advancement. It is, you invoke the names of writers from the UK. We can say, without writers, without artists, without painters, without musicians, no society can claim to be of any degree of sophistication without those being at the vanguard of whatever it is that they're pushing. So what I think our educationists have failed is to comprehend the roots, the colonial roots of this nonsense about pursuing certain crafts as a manifestation of our usefulness. There was something called, I don't want to be very academic, but there was a eugenics movement in the 1930s in this country that claimed that the brain development of a mature African man was equivalent to a European boy of 8 years. Consequently, they developed 3 academic programs, one for Indians, one for whites, and one for blacks, because our minds could not absorb this sophistication in education, what to be left to these Juakali, pursuits, not Juakali to indignify the informal sector, but work.
Ndugu, please fast forward. I'll accept if 60 years ago you called me an idiot, and now I've accepted it 60 years later. Aren't I going to, in some measure, realize that and move on? We seem to be stuck in this rut of, blaming the eugenics movement and colonialism.
Yes.
We're in charge.
Yes.
We're in charge. We've got our expressways going, zoom, we've got our, what have we also got? Our bypasses. We've got buildings that make Nairobi look like New York. but are we a literate society?
We are very illiterate, very ignorant, because we haven't transcended this mistake from the 1930s. We saw it replicated in 1984 when the 844 system was implemented. We've seen it in CBC, the same language of the eugenics movement being reproduced once more. So that's what you need to realize. We have repeated this mistake because you have not learned from history.
Right. Okay. Well, I think we're going to have our last break and then we'll try to end what could be a 3-year conversation. Ndugu, 19 hours, 16 minutes, 0 and 10 seconds. I'm going to say, Ndugu, we ought to perhaps have literary fairs, festivals. We had Story Moja, we had Kwani. We don't anymore. You might explain why. We don't have literary awards. We enter other competitions. The Burt Award has died. Our own Jomo Kenyatta Award, I think, gives a first prize of $500. And we are waiting for consecration from this bedeviled West. You know, my great dream as a writer is to be suddenly win the Booker Prize or something, that my fortunes will change, because I know there's nothing at home which comes close to the same level of recognition. And dare I say, we don't revere our authors. We don't revere our writers. I remember listening to a talk by Bethwel Kiplagat, the late Bethwel Kiplagat, who said that if you went off to Somalia and there was a guy walking along the street, they would say, "You see that man walking along? He's a poet." And people who were fighting would listen to the poet. I read Wilfred Thesiger, the great, you know, sort of walking through the whatever sands, talking about people in desert conditions who really revered the poet, the thinker, as a repository of all society's values. Somebody like you, I dare say, is considered in this society the scum of the earth, if I may insult you on there.
You have the poetic license, perhaps.
So, a festival, literary festival. What were the key words? Literary festival, literary prizes.
Yeah.
Waiting for recognition from abroad.
Well, it's an entire ecosystem that needs to be developed. Recognition and awards are only part of that. I would even say, we used to have a wonderful Kenya National Library Services that went around every corner of this country to disseminate knowledge to students in every corner of this country. So you might even extend that and say, when you get a book published in North America or Europe, a good chunk of that goes to public libraries, because books are a public good. So if you develop, so before you get to recognition and an award, I want us to have the books available to those who want to read. So I think what we have done very poorly as a society, and it's interesting because we have embraced everything else from our colonial masters besides their love for literature. If we extended the same, we'll be very far. So thankfully, what's happening is that although we are not dedicating resources to writers and artists to compose without the threat of being, you know, out in the cold, because you have to perhaps maintain a job as long as you are creating, we have failed to insulate our writers in every sense. And what's even most surprising is the level of taxes and levies imposed on books make them out of reach for a majority. So no one is going to develop our country for us. We have to do it. We have failed in the past 60 years, and I'm afraid this will go on for another 50, 60 years if we don't change our mindset that writing matters, writers matter. Writers and all the broad spectrum of creativity.
Ndugu, we've got very little time left, and I want to devote a great majority of it to talking about you once you reveal yourself. But before we get there, let's go back to this bellow quote. Who is the Tolstoy of the Zulus? Who is the Proust of the Papuans? I'd be happy to read them. Meaning that our mastery of language is wanting. We'll just never make it by some sort of eugenic defect. The question of language, bring back again your friend, my teacher, Ngugi wa Thiong'o. Has the language debate disappeared?
Well, it hasn't, and it won't for a long time to come.
So what are your views on it? Very quickly, maybe.
Very quickly, I'll say Bello was misguided in thinking that writing, good writing, because you're saying our mastery of language. Which language? Are you talking of Zulu writers writing in Zulu? Are you talking of a Luo writer writing in the Luo? Are you talking of... a Somali writer writing in Somali. Did he mean to ask who have you produced? Because there are many writers, I'm sure, in Zulu that Bello cannot access. So what I want us to dismantle is actually deferring to his statement, because he's making an implicit imposition that Shakespeare, who else did he mention?
Proust.
Proust, the French writer.
The Tolstoy,
the Russian.
Yes, exactly.
And I might, and I might say we have produced writers of that equivalence. He just can't access them in our languages.
Right. Well, for that section, I'm going to come up with another quote at the time that was a response to Saul Bellow. And the answer from a fellow writer was, Tolstoy is the Tolstoy of the Zulus. Unless you find profit in fencing off universal properties of mankind into exclusive tribal ownership.
Which That's is wonderful.
Which is, in a way, what you've just said. But who are you? Tell us who you are. I know who you are.
My name is Peter Kemani. I am a professor at Aga Khan University. And I'm also an author.
You are the author of Don't Be Humble. You are the author of Dance of the Jacaranda, at one time listed on the New York Times bestseller list. So for one thing, you must be rich. But let's go into the journey that made you. Is it too much to say that you and Yvonne Adhiambo Awoor are the two? I'll say it for you, because you won't say it for yourself. That it must be Peter Kemani and Yvonne Adhiambo Awoor. Who are the internationally recognized names from Kenya. We might go back to the late Binyavanga Wainaina, but sadly he is no longer with us. So since you are now, by definition, a flag bearer, and with great power comes with great responsibility, that whole sort of Batman thing, Superman, what are your words of wisdom to our young listeners on the topic of literature? Obviously, it means a lot to you. Is that something that you can articulate?
I would like to encourage them that although the iniquities against us are enormous, that writing comes from a place of deep conviction, and whatever it is that they want to convey to the world, they should believe it's both valid and important. And I am aware that there are many writers out there whose names we don't know yet. Many are going into self-publishing and distributing their books, in very difficult times and circumstances. I think I want to encourage them that it's going to be a journey rather than an event. So it's a process that will refine them as they go. And they should be encouraged to know they're writing in a time when perhaps social media, the much demonized platform, is actually giving them access to what we didn't have 20 years ago. So every work is important, every voice is important and should be nurtured.
Could we go back to what made you, you? People are always energized, you know, coming out, telling people, I'm just exactly like you and you're like me. As you encourage our young, predominantly young audience, give us a little potted biography that ends with you being on the New York Times bestseller list. I think we ought to say that you have been a past winner of the Jomo Kenyatta Prize for Literature for your story, When the Rooster Crows. So I know that. So you've been there, done that. How did you get there and how did you do it?
Well, it was actually for Upside Down, which is a children's book.
Not for When the Rooster Crows.
Before the Rooster Crows.
So you won it twice.
Was my first. It didn't win the prize, but my children's book did.
Yes.
I think what I can say that might be of value to young people who are listening is that before I became the author, you know, of those books, I was a long-time journalist for both The Nation and The Standard. And although journalism is non-fiction, it also did refine my art and my craft. By writing consistently, you have to practice your craft for it to improve. So what I would urge them is to find ways in which they can exercise that, where they can practice their craft. And so I was a journalist, and then I did receive formal training in creative writing, in my subsequent years. And I think what keeps me going even today is my practice as a journalist, because by writing consistently, you're sharpening your pen.
Can I give you 2 minutes to comment on a request that often comes to me, is that, would you please mentor me? So you went to school and studied it. How would you respond to that question? Is it good to have a mentor how do you encourage the other person to write?
Well, mentorship is a very useful thing. Every writer, I think, has had a mentor. I did. Ngugi has been my mentor for many years. Yeah, I'm ready and willing to be a mentor.
So if you were flooded after this program with 1,000 requests, would you?
I am happy to examine their request.
How would you go about mentoring? Would you just read every single script or text written by man or woman?
For the most part, yes.
Yes.
It's a huge commitment that requires you actually read and read closely what young writers are putting out. But because writing has no real set firm rules, what you give is advice. And they'll think about their material because they're the masters of their craft.
One more question, 1928. Should one write to become rich, Ndugu?
No, they should go into business. Yeah. If you want to be rich, go into business.
Right. Well, sadly, we have to stop there. It's just past 19 hours, 29 minutes and 2 seconds, and we have to stop. Do continue to give us feedback, hopefully positive and reassuring, on the Twitter handle at Capital FM Kenya, or drop us a text or WhatsApp message on 071-984-984. I've been talking to Professor Peter Kimani, journalism don and internationally acclaimed novelist, author notably of Dance of the Jacaranda. And you've been listening to John Sibio Kumu on Wednesday. Thank you so much for doing that. Much obliged. Until next time.